This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, thank you for coming to listen to me tonight. It's always a great pleasure to come and talk to the friends. I can see many of my old friends amongst the audience. It's also a pleasure to come and talk to you about one of my favourite topics, the desert, the deep history of the Australian desert. And tonight, I'll be talking about a desert journey. There's no better way to travel the desert than to walk it with a string of packed camels. It's a very special way to travel the desert. I speak to you about this journey with a little trepidation because the friends are an elite group, and many of you will have your own association with the desert. Some of you may have travelled the Simpson Desert. Some of you may have relatives who are involved in the phase of mineral exploration that swept across the Simpson Desert in the 50s. Some of you may be experienced cameleers. There's always surprises amongst the friends, I find. And perhaps some of you are here because you followed my little audio blog, which was a sort of an audio diary of the trip, which the museum asked me to do and which I enjoyed doing and felt worked rather well. Certainly it got a bit of a following in the museum, and there are lots of people on staff who I don't know very well who smile at me a lot now. And you may have also seen the piece in the Weekend Australian magazine by Nicholas Rothwell, which wasn't a bad piece. It sort of captured a bit of the flavour of the trip. Nicholas, being the journalist on the trip, with beautiful photos taken by Peter Eve. And Nicholas very kindly called me the Renaissance Man of Australian Desert Studies. I was a little nervous. He might have called me a lot of other things, but I was very pleased with that one. And for those who share my interest in deserts, there are more interviews, not so much about this camel trip, but about other aspects of the Australian desert, on Radio National Hindsight. And it's a program put together by Gretchen Miller called White Bone Country. And that's available on the web for download as a podcast. Well, I mean tonight to be fairly informal, but we're pretty wired up and we've got a battery of technology here, so perhaps it doesn't feel all that formal, but let's just take it that it's an informal chat. And what I thought I would do is to, first of all, use our connection to the internet to show you where this particular journey went, tell you something about how the journey was initiated, talk a little bit about the blog, play you one of the audio blog entries, and then sort of talk about the three stories that really intersect in this journey. The story of the desert and its history, the story of the actual travelling the desert itself, and of course the story of the people on the trip and the personalities, and included amongst the personalities, I mean the camels, which are the most charismatic animals with personalities of their own. And then most of tonight will be taken up with a sort of a rolling slideshow, and I'll give a little bit of a commentary, but by then you will have met the people and the camels and know a bit more about the journey. Well, this shows the location pretty well in the heart of the arid zone, not so much the heart of the continent, but in the driest part of Australia, in the Lake Eyre Basin. It's an interesting region because it's the part of the basin where annual rainfall gets down to around 100 millimetres per annum, which is really the boundary between arid and hyper-arid. So this is really the bottom end of the desert system. And on the map here, you can see Lake Eyre, and you've got the Warburton River, which is one of the rivers flowing into Lake Eyre, and the Cooper's a bit further over. Cooper's Creek, famous from the Burke and Wills episode. And the Culler Cooper is an old fossil branch of the Warburton. It leaves the Warburton, flows north into the desert, does a big bend, comes down, and doesn't actually rejoin the Warburton. I think it flows into the Macumba, which flows into the top end of, of Lake Eyre. The Simpson Desert is really one of the great deserts of the world. It's as you probably know, it's a triangular shape. It's bordered by the Fink and the Macumba on one side, by Eyre Creek, the Mulligan, Georgina rivers, and the Warburton and so forth on this side. And it's got the McDonnell Ranges and those northern rivers, the Plenty, Hay, Hale and Todd, etc., in the north. So it's a big triangular area of linear dune field. It's become a bit of a magnet for outdoor enthusiasts and four-wheel drive enthusiasts who see it as the most remote place in Australia and the desert they most want to cross. There are other places in the desert that are more remote, more lonely, more quiet. There are parts of the Simpson Desert where I think you could get run over if you weren't careful these days. But the southern bit of the Simpson Desert, in the apex of the triangle, is really rather special. It doesn't have the red sand and spinifex you've got further north. It has white sand. It has white sand because of its history, because of all the old rivers that flowed through this region, bringing down lots of fresh sand, which was then blown up into the dunes. So the colour of the landscape reflects its history. It's also much more barren than the landscape in the north, and there's an awful lot of salt and gypsum, again, from the rivers and the lakes, and particularly the stuff blowing out of Lake Eyre. So it's a very special part of the arid zone. It's been quite difficult to get into the loop of the Kalla Cooper. Four-wheel drivers sometimes get to the peak of the river, sometimes they get to the eastern end, and certainly paleontologists and other scientists have pretty well explored the river, so I don't want to pretend there's anything overly special about this trip. But for me, it's just been a wonderful opportunity to do an extended walk and to look at an entire landscape. Let's give you a bit of a sense of what the country looks like. The blue line is an approximation of the route, just joining the dots. In fact, our walking track was much more circuitous than that. But you can see it's an area of very regular linear dunes, typical desert dunes. And through this you have the old river, the old Kalla Cooper. And occasionally it has floodplains and blowouts and these big salt pans. This whole part of the Simpson Desert is it's an old depot basin. It's sinking, there's lots of alluvium. It's had a fairly complex history and quite a complex fluvial history. So you get a bit of a sense of the sort of country, where basically the route was to rendezvous near Kalamurina Station on the Warburton River. It was a cattle station, but it's recently been sold to Australian Wildlife Conservancy. It's quite an important area, the lower Warburton, which is down here, our departure point, because it's really the keystone ecologically for the whole region. All the water, all the floodwaters, everything that comes down from Queensland and enters Lake Eyre goes across Kalamurina Station through the Warburton or a little further south through the lower Cooper. So that becoming a conservation reserve has been quite important. Anyway, that was our point of departure. And we moved north through the dune field till we could intersect the Kalla Cooper. We followed it right around from its northernmost point down the western end, and then we had to cut back across the dune field. We could only get across the Warburton in one place because of all the floodwaters down from Queensland. There was a place called Stony Crossing. But this meant it was a very special time of year to travel because the country had had rain and it had floodwaters through. So more about the trip in a minute. But this map is part of something you can find on the museum's website and is associated with an audio blog that the public programs people of the museum asked me to do. Audio blogging is not my natural habitat, so again, I was a little apprehensive. But one of the great things about working at the National Museum is that It's a place that opens up possibilities and ideas, not closes them down. And I certainly like to do my bit to encourage new ideas. So I did my best to work with public programs. And so what we did was I was equipped with a satellite phone with a little solar recharger and asked to phone in every couple of days, phone in twice on each occasion, once to give my latitude and longitude so the position could be plotted on the map. And I suppose there was an OH&S aspect of that, but I don't know how anyone would have got me out if there'd been any problems. And the second call was the actual sort of diary entry. And I did try and think about how to tell the story of the trip and compose the blog in my mind. But in the hurly-burly of a camel trip, there are very few points in a day when you can skive off with a sat phone and have a quiet moment. So usually I was out shepherding camels, and the camels obviously were a bit bemused by what the hell was going on, and I would do my audio blog. And often it was bitterly cold, and it's hard to remember your lines and all of that sort of stuff. So there's an audio blog you can follow if you haven't seen it, and if you have followed it and enjoyed it, thank you for enjoying it. One of the things I learnt in the whole process from our web publishing people is apparently there's a whole website devoted to museum blogs. I have no idea what these blogs would be about, but it's a fascinating idea. What I'm going to do now is play one of these... Oops, what's happened? Play one of these audio blogs, just to give you the feel before we go into the main talk. And this is on the 17th of July, and I'm standing... It's a fairly. I've chosen this blog because it was a fairly typical sort of morning. It's early morning light. I'm standing out on the dunes looking after the camels. I'm not the only person looking after the camels. Our camp is down below me in the dune valley. Just little lines of camel gear and a little gleam of fire. And it's the whole romance of being part of a pastoral encampment like this caught my imagination.
Well, this is a familiar morning scene, but I want to describe it one more time. We've got a little encampment on a flat between high dunes. It's early morning. We've had minus 2.1 overnight. There's a little campfire gleaming in our camp. A plume of smoke is rising and flattening out as it hits the inversion layer. Along lines of camel saddles, pack saddles are laid out, and the morning sun is just picking out the red of the saddle blankets. And on the high dunes surrounding our camp, the camels are grazing. And peeked out on the skyline, you can just see the shepherds standing like sentinels there. The hands thrust deep into their pockets against the cold. The dingoes are howling in the dawn light, howling like wolves. Camel bells are jangling as our camels feed, sort of happily on the brows here. And as I watch, you can see people moving around in the camp in the valley floor, and you can hear just the faint hum of voices and of laughter and good fellowship. And as I watch, a couple of figures detach from me, from the firelight, and move off into the darkness, setting out to relieve the shepherds so they can come in and warm their hands at the fire and have a cup of tea. This must be a scene repeated in nomadic pastoral encampments over the centuries, in a score of encampments in Central Asia and in Iran and Rajasthan. But this is a Simpson Desert. I think we'll have camels, we'll be sharing our deserts with camels for quite a while to come, I think. There's also a sense now that our little caravan will soon disband. Probably in a day or so we'll be at the base camp. There'll be another mob of cavaliers coming in, another mob of travellers, and our little fellowship will disband. And so people are beginning to exchange addresses and emails and promising to keep in touch and so forth. there's a certain sadness in that, but there's also an anticipation of perhaps a wash and a good coffee somewhere down the track.
Okay, we'll come back and we'll play another blog in a few moments. You get a bit of a feel for the trip. Travelling with camels is, I think, physically hard. You're very exposed in this sort of open desert country, open arid steppe, to the cold and the wind, and you can pick that up in that sort of blog. It's very exhilarating country to travel through as well. Now, I see there being three intersecting stories in this that I'd really like to talk to you about today. I'll just see if I can get my computer woken up so we're ready. And we'll just call up this slide so we've got a bit of background. Well, the three stories that I see intersecting here are the desert and its history, my fellow travellers, the people and the camels, and the actual journey, what it's like travelling with camels through the desert. Well, the desert and its history. Those of you who have heard me speak before will know that reconstructing the environmental history and the human history of the desert is a consuming interest of mine. But I'd like to stress, I think it's a worthwhile interest and not just a tragic obsession. The Australian desert is the largest desert in the Southern Hemisphere and one of the largest in the world. It's 5 million square miles of quite diverse desert country. It's got dune fields, stony desert. It's got some fantastic desert ranges. It's got arid rivers. It's a continental desert with a great deal of diversity. And it covers 70% of the Australian landmass, so it's a very significant Australian habitat. In fact, it's one of the world's most distinctive habitats. And it's very important also for understanding the Australia that most of us live in, the Fertile Crescent in southeastern Australia, because there are really two great dynamics that structure our life, or the world we live in mainly. And one is the expansion and contraction of the desert over the last few thousand years, and the other is the rise and fall of the sea level. And between these two lie the woodland habitats and the river systems that we mainly live in. So understanding the desert and what it's doing on our borders is really quite important. So deserts are a grand passion, but a grand passion with some justification. I've been trying to pick through the human and environmental history of Australian deserts for some time now, and I like to think of the desert as a series of different deserts stacked on top of each other in time. So I like to think of the desert as a document. It has a history, it has a human history, it has an environmental history. And you can see traces of older deserts in the current landscape. It's a palimpsest, just like a medieval manuscript where you can see the older writing underneath the newer writing. And in the southern Simpson Desert, we've got an opportunity to glimpse three of these past deserts, three windows on the past. And the first one is really the last interglacial. It's a time before there were people in the desert. It's the last of these great wet pulses, climatic wet pulses that reactivate the river systems and the environments on the desert margin. And in the southern Simpson Desert, because the rivers are flowing down through this region into Lake Eyre, it's a very rich time. So we're talking 100,000 years ago. Now, Lake Eyre itself is a very interesting, has a very interesting history because the lake is essentially a giant continental rain gauge. It's fed by all the summer rainfall coming down those rivers into Lake Eyre, and the filling and emptying of Lake Eyre is a very good indication of the long-term environmental history of the continent, or at least the summer rainfall part of the continent. During the interglacial, when all of this system was active, the Kalakupa, the Warburton, the Lower Cooper were known to be quite rich habitats, quite a diversified region with coolabah, swampland, open grassland, low savanna, and with quite a range of fauna, many species of which are extinct now, including the giant marsupials and some other other large animals. So it was an area where we know there were diprotodon, which were sort of arid savanna animals, diprotodon being a sort of a bullock-sized marsupial, procoptodon, a giant short-faced kangaroo, Thylacoleo, the marsupial lion, a sort of a panther-sized relative of the possum with teeth like bolt cutters. Other animals like crocodiles, or crocodiles in the river systems, Saratoga-sized fish, large freshwater turtles, the chelids, freshwater crayfish. You can get the sense that this may have been a semi-arid system, but it was very rich, extraordinarily rich. And this whole system really ground to a halt as the interglacial came to an end. By its heyday was probably 100,000 years ago, but certainly its death knell was around 65,000 years ago, when Lake Eyre also stopped, filled for the last time and then dried. So for me, as I'm researching the desert, I'm really interested in what the desert was like on the eve of human settlement. And travelling through the Kalakupa has given me the opportunity to look at a landscape which we know was very rich in animals at one stage, sort of Australia's Serengeti, and where the fossil remains are known to be quite abundant. And that proved to be the case, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a minute. The second window was to wonder what happened during the last glacial maximum, the really tough period, the really dry period in the Australian desert. We know large parts of the desert were probably abandoned by people. We know that people persisted in some areas like Western Central Australia. What actually happened in the Kalakupa region? There were massive exposures of the dune sands that built up during this time. So it's a very good opportunity to look to see if we could see any evidence of human occupation. And the third window was on the recent prehistory. The Southern Simpson Desert was occupied by Aboriginal people in historic times, a group of people called Wangkunuru, and they're a classic desert people living in very small numbers of people, living in a very lean landscape, but of course this was their land, and the traces of their occupation are scattered through the Simpson Desert. And I wanted to have a bit of a look to get a measure of the density and distribution of archaeological remains. The trip, of course, was really an Australian desert expeditions trip. Andrew Harper runs one of the two or three commercial camel operations, long-distance camel operations in Australia, Outback Camel Company. But recently, as he's become a bit more secure in his business, he wants to pursue his own interest in the desert by establishing a research arm. So essentially, I got an email one day saying, we're running this expedition, would you like to join us as a researcher, as our guest? So it's a wonderful opportunity. It comes, of course, with no control over where the trip goes. It goes where the camels can find food. It goes where Andrew needs to go because he's got to get back to a useful point to then run the next trip with paying customers. But it's a wonderful initiative on Andrew's part. And I was very pleased on my part, because every now and then research runs in cycles. I'm sure you know this. Many of you are probably retired or not so retired researchers. At times you're focused down. You're writing your book. You're digging your trench. You're really focusing on a region. You're trying to pick it apart. And every so often you've got to step back from that. Every so often an archaeologist has got to get out of their trench and walk across an entire landscape and get the measure of it. And this gave me a wonderful opportunity to do that through Australian desert expeditions. Well, what did we find? What were the results broadly on those three windows? What did we learn about the history of the desert, or what did I see? Well, first of all, in terms of the fossil remains, we quickly found that the fossil remains were very widely distributed. There's an old land surface, which is a reddish alluvial deposit. It's It's very cemented with gypsum, so it really dates from the time when the rivers were drying and gypsum was being deposited under seasonally wet but very hot, dry conditions as well. And on this surface, we'd find bits of the large animals, and you'll see them. I mean, it's just, if you walked over pastoral country or cattle country, you'd occasionally find a jaw of a cattle, a backbone of a sheep, the leg of a kangaroo or something, and that's what we were finding. Isolated skeletal elements scattered across the country, but they were Diprotodon, they were Genyornis, they were Procoptodon, they were crocodile. And occasionally we'd find remains of old river channels that had been cut into that land surface, and there we would find fish vertebrae, catfish spines, crocodile teeth, bits of crocodile skull, and so forth. So it's a very vivid invocation of this wetter landscape. And I'll show you some pictures of those fossils, all very fragmented, but a very interesting landscape. The last glacial maximum. Oops. We had very extensive exposures of the dune sands. These are tough, laminated dune sands, pale in colour. I thought, we must find a fireplace. We must find something. But they're really sterile. There's no sign of people in these dune sands. Given our own experience out there, where it was intensely cold, -4 one night, and there's not much fuel wood, you're pretty exposed. I mean, if you're dropping down into a glacial, which is 4 or 5 degrees Celsius below today on average, then the lack of fuel wood, and it's drier, so there's even less fuel wood, the lack of fuel may in fact be as much a limitation as anything else. It's likely to be a very tough environment. The recent archaeology, I logged all the artifacts and remains I saw, and I think they give a very sort of a consistent picture. Once you get to the first major waterhole on the Kalakupa, you've got all the signs of it being a focus for occupation. You've got little fireplaces with the clay that was used as a heat retainer. You've got the grindstones used for grinding seeds. You've got the chula radzes, which are one of the woodworking tools, which are really a good indication that people are spending a bit of time repairing their gear. You've got piri points, which are a spear point. Again, you're going to find them where people are spending a bit of time repairing their gear, so they're sitting down for a while. And the subsequent trip found a burial. And as we move further into the desert, the artifacts got sparser and sparser and sparser until we got to the northern bend of the Kalakupa. And then we started to get a lot more stuff again, but a greater diversity of material, because this is where people from right across the desert were coming into the river channel. And so there were very interesting patterns. And on the return trip, again, artifacts were very sparse, and then over a few days, we began to notice larger and larger pieces of stone. And this is a stone-free area, by and large. These are artifactual stone. People are throwing away a lot of stuff. They're bringing in big cobbles of silkcrete. I was saying to our companions, we're near a quarry. We've got to be near a quarry for this much stone to be around. And then a couple of days later, we crossed a dune, and there was an outcrop of silkcrete, a sort of gibber surface, with the remains of the old quarry pits. Probably the only source of stone north of the Warburton. So it was nice to be proved moderately right instead of wrong. But that was a sort of... So we've got a very interesting picture now of the distribution of recent archaeological remains in the Simpson Desert, and that will build as we get other information. The journey. Well, travelling with camels, I think, is by now an Australian tradition, 150 years of travelling the interior with camels, basically walking with them carrying your gear. Many of the cameleers, of course, were Muslim and were from northwestern India or Pakistan, but not all. There are other groups, including Anglo-Australians, as cameleers. It's a marvellous way to travel, but you're walking all the time, constantly walking. Almost everything you do is walking. You're shepherding the camels, you're walking during the day, you're shepherding them at night. We covered 300 kilometers in our trip. We were walking with two strings of pack camels. The camels, when we say a string, it's the old way where the camels have a head rope, and the head rope of one camel attaches to the head rope of the camel in front, and so forth. And camels characteristically will have nose pegs through the septum of their nose. They're not used a lot these days, but there's an opportunity to attach a string from the nose peg to the head rope if the camel is being a bit bolshy. But well brought up camels, you don't have that problem with. We were walking for 23 days without a wash. Well, not we weren't walking for 23 days. We had a couple of days when we were sort of in a camp waiting for something to happen. Initially, when we set out on our first day, it was a bit of a shambles. The camels had 5 weeks' holiday and were all frisky and didn't have their mind on the job and didn't know who we were, and we didn't know how to handle camels, and we only made 4 kilometres. But we quickly got into our stride and we were making 18 kilometres a day, which wasn't bad. And there were 17 camels, and there were 16 people, plus Mr. George, the dog, who was Andrew's dog, and he had a self-appointed sort of duty statement to herd the camels. The camels totally ignored him. He was an eye dog who was very keen to make eye contact with camels and control them that way, but they just didn't make eye contact, so it was totally hopeless. Of the people, there were 6 cameleers, more than the usual number for a trip of this size, but that was to compensate for the fact that we had 4 researchers who it was understood would probably have a lot of their hands full with their own research, so wouldn't be available to handle the camels. We had 2 journalists, Nicholas Rothwell and Peter Eve, and we had 4 paying travellers who were travelling for the sheer pleasure of travelling in the desert, and mainly were repeat travellers, so they've really are people who've got the bug. And I know there are people in the audience who have travelled with Andrew on the trip following this trip, and I have 2 of my guests here tonight were on the trip with me as well. The daily routine. Let me give you a bit of a sense of the daily routine. Pardon me if you're an experienced camel traveller and this is just camel travelling 101, but usually what would happen would be rise fairly early. In my case, I was keen to pull my weight as a sort of quasi-camelia. So when Wilco, our 86-year-old camelia, who's ex-military, ex-World War II military, New Guinea rifles, Wilco would be spring out of bed with military precision. It might have been 5 a.m., it might have been 6 a.m., he had a little alarm. So I would more or less follow him out. You know, I'd sort of roll out of bed when Wilco got up. And I'd have a quick cup of tea. It was dark, it was cold. And I'd go out and shepherd the camels. I mean, it didn't seem right for a researcher to sort of lay around the fire, having a meal, having, you know, chatting while 86-year-olds out there doing all the hard work minding the camels. So I'd go out, and Wilco and I usually had a good time minding the camels. And then gradually, other people would come out and relieve us, and we'd go in and get our breakfast. And there was always a bit of a changeover. Everyone was very supportive. And then you've got to pack all the camel gear, and it always goes in the same packs, and the packs are always in the same order, and they always go in the same camel because the weight of the packs is important. You've got to get the balance right. And on a good day, we'd be ready to head off by about 9. The camels have had plenty of time to have been, they've had plenty of time to feed. You've got to unhobble them when you bring them in, sit them down in their lines, and load them up. Some of the camels, only the cameleers unhobbled because they were either trainee camels, so a bit nervous, and you know, were still likely to say, oh, you know, that's a lion trying to get my foot, I've got to kick it. And some were just grumpy. There were a couple of camels that were just, tended to be just a bit sort of fractured. And then you set off, and you're walking at a fairly brisk pace, maybe 4 kilometres an hour. And Andrew is picking his roots. You've always got one camellia leading each string. You've got the other camellias working backwards up and down the string, just enveloping the camels in a string in commands and a sense that they're part of a herd. You know, walk up, steady camels, you know, back up, you know, because sometimes they're crowding up to get at some feed. I mean, they can be like sort of pushy school kids, you know, they're sort of crowding forward and you've got to get them back in a line. And the lead camellia would pick the route. And you'd head off at 4 kilometres an hour, doesn't sound much, but it is a fairly cracking pace. If you stop to look at a plant or something, the whole string is going to disappear over the horizon fairly quickly. So you don't have time to dilly-dally. We would sit the camels down at lunchtime and have a quick lunch. We had a table, so we were quite, it was quite luxurious. The food got was pretty good, but you're burning a lot of energy because you're in the cold wind all the time, you're walking all the time, so you know you can just feel yourself getting smaller and tightening your belt and stuff. And then round about 4 p.m., 3:30, 4 p.m., we'd pick a place where there was good forage for the camels and we'd make camp, and then you'd have to sit the camels down, unload the camels. The camp was always laid out in the same way, so it had the same social geography. You knew where people were. If you had to go to the loo at night, didn't fall over anyone. You knew where the gear was if a rainstorm came in, so you know there wasn't too much chaos. All of that sort of stuff. And the camels then were released out to graze or browse. So that was the routine. I found that at night, some of the nights were really dark. When you had a moonlit night, it was beautiful, but some nights were so dark that if you went for a walk away from your swag, you had Buckley's chance of finding your swag again. So I had a little strobe light which I would put on, just like a little flashing bike light, and that allowed me to find my swag because you want to go for a walk, you want a bit of privacy, you walk over 2 or 3 dunes, you've got no idea where your swag is by the time you're coming back. And unless you want to walk around for 4 or 5 hours in the dark, it's good to have a flashing light. Okay, the journey. Well, we set out from Kalamurina, and the first leg of the journey was really walking north, crossing the dune field. And let's get this up again. And we were trying to avoid a part of the Kalakupa where the channel is very diffuse and has lots of floodplain and that. And we wanted to get to where the channel was entrenched, and we did. And there was a lot of water. To our surprise, there was a lot of water there. It doesn't seem to be flood water, but it doesn't seem to be flowing down the channel, but it mainly seems to be water that's running in off the surrounding country. So the river channel's acting like a rock hole, really, and there's fresh water sitting on top of the salt. And there were birds, there were waterfowl, ducks, pelican, black swans, really rather lovely. And walking through country that is rich with yellow daisies, it was like the sound of music, you know, sort of. Expected Julie Andrews to come over the next June. It was really very pleasant country. But at the waterhole, our first big waterhole, we found it, it was fresh, we thought we'd go for a swim, and while one of the other researchers, a biologist, Deb, who was from the Department of Environment and Heritage in South Australia, slipped on the mud. It was very treacherous around the edge of these waterholes. You couldn't get near the water for the soft mud. She slipped and fell backwards and broke her wrist. And we were 4 days' walk in, and 4 days' walk from the nearest point where we could get a vehicle, or 5 days' walk. So that was a bit of it was an example of what can happen. And although I've often felt very comfortable in the desert, when something happens like that, you realise how remote you are. Fortunately, Michael, who's here with us today, is an ex-RFDS doctor, and he knew exactly what to do and reduce the fracture. And Joe, one of the camellias, was an ex-nurse's aide, so he did a very good job of splinting the arm up. And Andrew, who'd never had this sort of problem on a trip before, really had a very good contingency plan and got on the sat phone and rang around the stations, and we got a helicopter. So within a day, we actually had a helicopter from Birdsville to evacuate her out. She was very lucky, otherwise she would have had to walk for 5 days with a broken wrist, which would have been very, very unpleasant for her. Well, when we moved further north, we had a couple of days while we sorted that out. As we moved further north, again following the channel, very pleasant country, daisies. We eventually got to the top end of the Kalakupa, where it bends around. And that's where there's some old evidence of four-wheel drive access, where there's some traces of the oil and gas exploration of the 1950s and 60s. And this is where Nicholas left us, and where a couple of other biologists came in, Andrew Black and Nerissa Habe. Now, the biologists were doing plant collections, they're recording birds, and they were doing a bit of nighttime trapping to try and identify what small marsupials were on the dunes. But it was very lean country, and really the major animals were rabbits, camels, dingo, and emu. The small bird life, the wrens were, and chats, and that were quite prolific, but it was very, very lean country. Coming down the western side, it was country that was much more barren. No rain had fallen there, and it gave you a real sense of what the country would look like normally. Well, I've already said a little bit about the people on the trip. Before we just see the slides, let me tell you about the other personalities, the camels. Camels, of course, have been domesticated for quite a few thousand years, maybe about 5,000 years in the Middle East, but they really didn't spread into the areas we most associate them with, like North Africa and the Sahara, until the Arab invasions around 700 AD. In Australia, they started to be introduced from about 1840 onwards, and numbers gradually built up to the 1900s. They're very charismatic animals, I think. They're very intelligent, but they're slow revving. The camel knows what you want him to do, but it's going to take him a while to do it. You know, it's like turning an ocean liner. They turn slowly. They'll do it, and you don't want to bully them. And on a camel, if a camel's being slow, sometimes there's a reason. You know, it's about to urinate, or the camel knows that he's got a few more minutes before he has to get into line and wants to really finish eating that delicious plant. You know, you've got to roll with what the camel wants a little bit. But although they're big animals, they're actually quite fragile, I think, mentally. They're easily unnerved by episodes of bad handling. And that maybe explains the bad reputation they've got in Australia, where camels are sort of regarded as being cantankerous, bad-tempered animals. Well, our camels were marvellous animals. But because I'd travelled before, I could see the changes in some of the camels. Sang, who you'll meet, was a lovely camel, very steady, a good lead camel, very relaxed. But since that last trip, has had some bad experiences with handling and is now just a bit nervy and a bit likely to snap. Never making contact, you just hear the closing, you know, by your ear. And Sang now is, you know, number two from the end of the string. So Sang has had a fall from grace. Yes. New recruits. Some of the camels in the string were new recruits. You'll meet little Mojo, who was the son of Morgan, one of the big camels. Little Mojo looked like his dad, strawberry blonde camel, very stocky build, very, very keen to do the right thing, but very nervous. And so Mojo needed careful handling. He's going to be a really good camel, but he wants to do the right thing, but just a bit nervous. He even put himself in the line by himself in the morning. He was so keen to do the right thing. And then Gus, a lovely sort of ginger-haired camel, lovely soft eyes, a lovely personality, but very nervous. When you put the crupper strap around his tail, he's very nervous about people touching his rear end. When you're loading him up, he's sometimes very nervous and tries to grab you by the ankle. And Joe used to joke that he was trying to grab you by the ankle and throw you in the air. But he's not a sinister camel, just nervous. And he was growing in confidence as the trip went along. Older camels that have their own way of doing things. Nugget, who was a rear camel of A string, a real gent, but sort of an older camel, Very doesn't want to be mucked around, doesn't want to be cuddled too much, doesn't want to be talked to too much, knows the ropes, just wants to be left to get on with it. Steady camels, Morgan, big bull camel, strawberry blonde, father of Mojo. Camels seem to come in two varieties, a big, heavy-duty pack camels, very steady, and then a smaller, leaner, more skittish variety. Other good camels, TC, who's a lead camel, Woody, Char, who's a bit of a saint, carries big boxes. Char was totally unperturbable. The cameleers used to joke he was an astral traveller. He always seemed to be off somewhere else. And then Istan, the one camel that wasn't in a string, that was a riding camel, and Wilco, our 86-year-old camelier, rode Istan. Istan was a lovely camel, very sweet-natured, very steady, but a real foodie. And the only time he disobeyed a command was when he was after food. And you can, and he's got this wonderful broken nose. And then larrikins, Banjo. Banjo, good-natured camel, but you could see the gleam in his eye, and he knew he was going to roll over with his saddle on. And, you know, it just happened time and time again. And then very, very temperamental camels. Colson, the bad boy of the class. If he was in the class, he'd always be the boy pushing forward, sticking his pen into someone else, one moment being good, next moment, you know, burping, or, you know, like Colson was the lout of the string. Sultan was just bad-tempered. Sultan was a scumbag. There was no other way around it. And I had to work Sultan. And Sultan was really hard work.
Could you tell them apart?
Yes.
Did you call them by name, or did you learn?
The camels do have all their own personalities. I think it's very important to learn to recognise camels as individuals and to learn their strengths and weaknesses. There's an important aspect to this, is you're safer if you know where you stand with a camel. You know which camels to stay away from, you know which camels are likely to kick you, and those, you know, which camels that are very forgiving. So although, you know, there's a lot of anthropomorphizing going on here, there's actually an important edge to it. I've run a bit over time, so I think I'll finish there, but it's been a great privilege for me to be able to travel country, just to walk for an extended period across such an interesting bit of desert, courtesy of Australian Desert Expeditions. We hope to develop more of a research partnership with them in coming years, but if you ever get the chance to walk the desert with camels, I recommend it. And it's, the desert has its own personality, but it's also worth getting to know camels and how they operate, because I think they're very interesting animals. Thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.